Are you enjoying the Dharmakaya this morning?
It's a little cooler this morning. Dharmakaya.
Dharmakaya's a little cooler. The Dharmakaya manifested in the form of lots of bats flying around in the dusk. I just thought of this story in the Blue Cliff Record, so that's what I went to go look for just now. It's case 82, called here Tai Ryu's Indestructible Dharma Body. We have another Zen expression about this Dharmakaya, this true body of the Buddha.
Could you pass it to Buddha?
In which a monk said to Tai Ryu, the person's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? And Tai Ryu said, flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The veil lies deep in shade. What is this indestructible Dharmakaya? The pure Dharmakaya neither appears nor disappears. The Buddha's formless, indestructible realization. Perfect wisdom, non-dual awareness, endowed with Buddha qualities of great compassion, free from all dualistic obscurations. What is that anyway? Flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The veil lies deep in shade. Again, the great earth in 10 directions, nature as it is. Only in the Zen school do they speak of the Dharma body like this. This Katsuki Sekida, in his comments on this, says, it will probably not be difficult for you to arrive at a conceptual understanding of Tai Ryu's meaning in these words. That the phenomenal world is reality. The blooming flowers, the dark valley are themselves the indestructible Dharma body. But such understanding will not give you true peace of mind. That can only be attained only through your practice of Zazen. In samadhi, you will one day find that you are freed from your nervous turmoil. And that is all. If you then look at the flowers on the hillside, you will find that they're so close to you that they sink into your eyes and penetrate your body.
What an image.
But at the same time, they're there on the hillside. Sometimes in Sashin, we walk out of the Zendo so open that it's almost as if the grasses and trees are sinking into our eyeball. Or this excruciating intimacy with the world of nature all around the Jikoji Pure Land. So they're so close to you, they sink into your eyes and penetrate your body, but at the same time they're there on the hillside. This is what we call pure cognition, the pure intuitive activity of your first thought, your first mind movement has been unified with the object. You will realize that you are cognizing the Dharma body in the flowers. This kind of realization is quite different from conceptual understanding, and it brings true peace of mind. To the monk in the present story here, who had not yet attained genuine samadhi, Tai Ryu's answer must have seemed remote and irrelevant. However, the teacher must sometimes be cruel. Tai Ryu had no qualms about depriving the monk of his treasured belief in the indestructibility of the Dharma body, for that belief was based on nothing more than a conceptual understanding. You see how this is relevant to our study? The monk might have been shocked to hear that the indestructible Dharma body of the Buddha was just these quickly fleeting, blooming flowers, colors and sounds on the hillside. Back to our story. Which continues, but now we have some real, again, concrete, practical zazen instruction or life instruction. I feel like this is one of those straightforward teachings, and as we start to look at it, it seamlessly flows out of everything we've heard so far. But on the surface, this is very straightforward and can be taken that way. This is at, I think, top of page 3. Long ago, a monk asked an old master. The monk happens to be Genjo Bao Sho. When hundreds, thousands, or myriads of objects come all at once, what should be done? The master replied, "Don't try to control them." That's enough to practice the rest of our life. Simple and straightforward, difficult to do, but this is freedom, is it not? And hundreds, thousands, or myriads of objects, sometimes translated as, you know, phenomena or appearances or conditions and circumstances. This Chinese character is the one that's used to translate the Sanskrit vishaya, which means literally objects, like perceptual and conceptual objects. So each of the six senses has an object. So eye consciousness has color, ear consciousness as sound, smell, taste, touch, and tangible objects, and mind objects. These are like the objects that come at us continuously. Hundreds of thousands and myriads are coming actually right now. All six senses. Maybe we aren't tasting very much except the slight residue of tea on the tongue. But colors and sounds and physical sensations and mental ideas are assaulting us every moment. So what should be done in such a case? As right now, hundreds, thousands of myriads of objects coming all at once, what should be done? Don't try to control them. Or manage them. Other translations. Be in charge of them. It's the kan that's in shikan taza. As a compound, shikan means only or just. So kan, in this sense, has the connotation. I would understand it as limiting, just only sitting. Not exactly like controlling our sitting, right? But taken on its own, kan means like to control or to govern, regulate, control. Don't try to do that. So, especially in Zazen, we can really notice all this stuff coming into our mind. Particularly like difficult physical sensations, painful sensations when sitting long. How can we manage them and control them, make them as comfortable as possible? And we can just spend all of Zazen trying to somehow control our experience as if there's like me that's managing the objects of my experience. And it's possible to just give up control, surrender. And, you know, it's that wonderful paradoxical experience that we have, because it looks like Zazen is very controlled, right? We have this very specific form and posture. It looks as if it's like completely controlling our experience. So we have that aspect of we set up a specific posture, not much more than that actually, a posture and a natural breath, and then within that setup, within that upright body, then just completely let go. This is very specific upright body, and then we drop off the body and mind. So, as a basic instruction, doesn't that seem quite straightforward? When all the objects are coming, the practice is not control them. Also, we have in the Gendo Koan, the classic instructions of Dogen, he says, to carry oneself forward and experience myriad things. We can maybe edit it a little bit and say, to carry the self forward and control the myriad things. Is delusion. That's the definition of delusion. Trying to manage our experience from the point of view of the self that's carried forward. And then he says, when the myriad things come forth, hundreds, thousands of objects come forth, and experience the self, or experience themselves, this is realization. This is Satori. Literally, we could translate this part of the Gendo Koan as to carry the self forward and practice and realize the myriad things is delusion. It's got that phrase that Dogen loves so much, practice and realization, stuck in there. To carry the self forward and practice and realize or verify myriad things with the self that's carried forward is delusion. But the myriad things come forth and practice and realize or verify the self is realization or awakening. And we have the story. story about the pulley and the well. Right? So the pulley that's doing all the work, controlling the Buddha water in the well, trying to scoop up that water from the point of view of itself. It's looking down at the well from its own self-effort. And we do that. We have intention in Zazen. It's not like we give up all intention. I think this moment of letting go of control is once we've aroused the intention to sit upright, let our breath settle, and there's a little bit of almost like control going on there. And then within that, then we can let go. So we can look down, intentionally look down at the water, and then we can let the water of the well look up at us, the rusty pulley. So in the Book of Serenity, where the story appears, there's the verse comments on this pulley and the well story also bring out this principle. So that the comment on it's like a pulley looking at the well, the verse is the falling flowers consciously follow the flowing stream. So it's like there's the flowing stream of Buddha, and us little impermanent falling flowers, we fall into that and we try to accord with that flowing stream, like the pulley looking at the well. And then the comment on the well, the clear well water looking up at the pulley, is the flowing stream mindlessly carries the falling flowers. The falling stream, Buddha, mindlessly, unintentionally carries us. So these are all different images for when we let go of all our control and even intentionality, then we're just carried by the flowing stream. But there's these two sides to say that we can consciously follow the flowing stream is actually 80% of practice. It's pretty good. 80% is like, let's intentionally try to attend to this mind, and then the complete story is that this mind just carries us. This nature of mind is when we completely give up control and surrender to it, it just carries us. Like the night train carries us even while we sleep. So, not trying to control him. If we don't remember anything else here and it starts to get complicated now, just don't try to control what's going on here or the rest of the session. But now we can delve deeper. Now we're going to hear Dogen's comment. Well, first let me just bring up the slightly extended version of this story. Andy Ferguson here, Baosho Yang Zhao. A monk asked Baosho, when all these objects come forward and overwhelm you, that's how he translates it, then what? Baosho said, don't control them. And now the extended version is, the monk bowed. Which often is the happens when they kind of appreciate the answer. They often have some insight, so in thanks they bow. The monk bowed, and Baosho then said, don't move. If you move, it will break you in two at the waist. It sounds like, so even his bowing at the waist is already too much, you know. Baosho being very strict, don't try to control anything here. just stand there dumbfounded in awe of this uncontrollable Dharmakaya. Don't even go so far as to bow. Don't move. If you move, it, what, the world of objects, will break you in two at the waist. So then Dogen comments now. What he means here about don't control them is that in whatever way objects come, don't try to change them. Which goes back to these earlier instructions too about don't wish for more color or brightness than when viewing the flowers and the moon. It's kind of like, let's control the flowers and the moon a little bit by adding a little color. Don't try to change them. Whatever comes is the Buddha Dharma, not objects at all. Do not understand the Master's reply as merely a brilliant admonition, but realize that it is the truth. Even if you try to control what comes, it cannot be controlled. Therefore, don't even bother. But I think a key sentence here is that whatever comes is the Buddha Dharma, not objects at all. So this is, we could say, the reason that we can't control them, and that it's delusion to try to control objects, is because they're not really objects. Colors, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and mental ideas are not really objects. They're actually Buddha Dharma. Any thoughts on how it is that these objects might not be objects? If they're not objects, what are they? Well, they're Buddha Dharma, but specifically, what type of Buddha Dharma are these colors and sounds and ideas and thoughts?
Maybe senses?
Senses, meaning?
Our smell, our eyes, our nose, our hearing.
So so like a sound isn't actually a sound, but it's our sense of sound, you mean? Like our ear consciousness, something like that. Yeah, I think something like that is that they're not really out there. Now this is where we're getting into the, please excuse me, the realm of mind only. Because this next section is, I think, really pretty straight up mind only teaching coming here. And it seems to be maybe not necessarily connected to this, but this is a way it's connected, is that objects like colors and sounds and so on are not out there, but they're aspects of our mind. So, like Rain said, we could maybe see them as they're like sound consciousness. The sound isn't actually sound, it's sound or ear consciousness. But taking it even further back, they just say that they're all projections of mind arising from this storehouse consciousness. This is a teaching of mind-only tradition, is that even what we call the objects of the material world, like colors and sounds and so on, are not actually a material world out there apart from mind, but they're mind projections. And if we hear it that way, then we realize how off it is to try to control them, because it's really like we think we're controlling something out there, but it's really that we'll be trying to control our own mind with our own mind. Yes.
Well, think one could begin to suspect that maybe their mind only is like a huge ego trip on the human beings, but to bring everything into their own sort of realm. But in our current age, we could also see all of these objects as just energy forms, and nothing fundamentally. That so in that sense, they're not very distinguishable from each other, and could sort of go toward the sense of the great world or universe.
We could say they're energy forms, inconceivable energy forms, but I think if we look at the way we experience them, when we look at a color or hear a sound, it seems also that even I would understand that even like modern scientists would say the way we perceive the world is through the filter of our own mind. So like that we look at a tree and even immediately before we think any thoughts about it, we see a green leaf. Already that's like we're not seeing it directly. Even when we see it so-called directly, it's actually, we're not seeing the leaf itself. Right? We're seeing, if we're talking about non-conceptual image, we're still seeing a visual image on the back of our retina, scientifically speaking, right? And so...
Actually, it's more complicated than that, even. That we see sense data, and sense data comes in, and it's like it, like this sense data is like one person that comes into a committee room, and there's a whole bunch of people sitting down at the table, and they sit around and they discuss what it actually is and kind of vote on it, and that's what we see.
So there's some discrimination going on.
Definitely,
there.
Like we have a pattern, we have a view, we already have a preconception. Conceptual view of what a tree is, what green is, what, and all those elements come together, you know, very fast.
And is it, that's even like pre-conceptual, would you say? Even in direct sensory experience, is there the committee, or does the committee come later?
I think it comes with samskara, with conception.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is definitely like a big committee.
Yes.
When we get into like, even to name it green, even before we name it as a tree, to name it as green, or experience it as green, maybe takes a pretty big committee. But
they've actually studied this, and they say that the electrical energy that they recorded in the way the brain is stimulated, the input of sense coming in, mm-hmm. is some very small percent, less than 10%, that comes in, but the electrical energy that comes out to actually have this conception is like, you know, it's more than 90%.
That reminds me of one of the photography training I received quite back, just to look at the picture upside down, so that you can really see and increase the amount of input you get by removing the filter. So it may be difficult to remove the filter tree because if it's upside down, tree kind of looks like trees.
Mm-hmm.
But for a certain object, it really works well. And say, and looking at some that looks stunned or something, if you put it upside down.
Yeah.
Or if you, I think I remember.
Artists do that to draw.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They can draw better, actually. If they don't, if there's something called, it's called image identification.
Mm-hmm.
If image identification drops away and they're just able to see pure form or pure color.
Interesting.
They can actually. They can do a better job at rendering it.
Yeah, I think the famous example is to make the continent of Africa kind of upside down or maybe sideways, then you will not recognize it as Africa. So you see more, you know, small, that's much bigger.
Interesting. Yeah, so we have all these generic images of things that we're so habituated to see. So it's hard. That's a great example. It's hard to see what's really there freshly because it's so overlaid with generic conceptual versions of things.
Maps, just like maps. Africa, like you mentioned. Yeah. They're all mental maps.
Yeah. So isn't it funny, too, there's another example, too, that we see a map or even a photograph from space of Africa, and we say, somebody asks, what is that? We say, that's Africa. And we actually think that that is Africa, right? It's got, like, almost nothing to do with what's actually when you, if you were just landed in Africa, where you might not even know where you are. But we think that that image is Africa. I mean, if someone were to ask, do you really think it is? We'd say, no, I don't really mean that. But our first take on it is we can say, yeah, that's Africa. So conceptuality. And so it's an interesting point is, you know, does mind only sound like a big ego trip? Well, also, we don't say that, I mean, there's different aspects of mind, one of which we could call ego, like the sense of oneself as a kind of separate self, but mind-only tradition doesn't really say that the ego is projecting the world. It's more like something deeper than our sense of self. It's like this automatic process of projection. But we could say, I could see how one could say, well, the whole idea sounds kind of self or... We had this discussion somewhere before, I remember, it sounded like, you know, like self-centered or human-centered, and I said something like, well, it is kind of sentient being-centered. It's not just that humans do this, all sentient beings would do this. Or we could even say it's kind of mind-centered, and mind-centered may be another translation for mind-only. And we could say also, like Jero says, what about just seeing everything as energy, movement? Like we could see it as that, but the mind only emphasis is on like how we experience it. It's almost like saying experience the experience only school. From the point of view of our experience, we can never, you know, we can never contact something outside of our experience, right? That's maybe obvious. Like if there's just some energy outside of perception and cognition, there may be, in which case we could say that that's not mind only. But if there was such a thing, we'd never know it, right? Because the only way we know the world is through our mind. So it's kind of just saying, I think we don't need to go so far as to say there really is no material world, period. It's just mind.
That's, what do they call it, solipsism?
Well, I think solipsism would be to say that there's only me. Like, all of you are just my mind, and you don't exist
That's
at
right.
all. That would be solipsism. But, you know, it looks like the Indian tradition of mind-only, like Asanga, the founder, really does seem to emphasize in a quite detailed way that he's really proposing that there really isn't a physical and material world. But we could say we don't even need to go that far to have it be useful. We could just say, if there is an actual world out there apart from mind, there may or may not be, but if so, we'll never know. It's like impossible to know. Even if it's like scientific data can prove one way or another, the data is coming through our own mind, right? It's like we only have this lens of human consciousness to experience colors and sounds and stuff. We can deduce, well, we all agree on these colors, so there must be an objective color outside of our unique experience. But again, all of that is coming through our kind of shared sensory apparatus. We're very similar as sentient beings, so, and especially as humans, so we do perceive things.
Similar. We do have the circumstance of like knowing that particular objects have conditions, mm-hmm. preceding conditions, conditions that caused it to be.
Uh-huh.
And we can deduce from that that there's conditions preceding awareness of conditions.
And one of the main conditions for the experience of seeing black is our mind is a condition, right? You could say that even if we're talking about previous conditions for that, you could say the previous mind moment is the condition for this mind moment.
Yeah.
So mind only keeps turning it all back inward like this. Even dependent co-arising is still a valid teaching, but it's like the main kind of dependence we're talking about is dependence on our own perceptions and mind. So I don't know if that seems less like an ego trip to say that there may or may not be so-called material elements out there, like earth, wind, fire, and water, you know, however many periodic table elements there might be. But if there are, we only know them, we can only experience them or know anything about them through mind. It's kind of talking about not so much like I think mind only is not so much about ontology, meaning like the nature of whether things exist or not. It's more about epistemology, like how we know things. And it's saying we can't really say anything about ontology, like the status of existence or non-existence, because all we have is our limited, relatively speaking, pretty limited human consciousness. Or even I was talking with this scientist about having like a Buddhism he was a physicist, a kind of dialogue, Buddhism physics dialogue, and I was proposing, it looks like one of the differences here between science, physics and science, and Buddhism is that Buddhism says, especially from this mind-only perspective, is that we can't really say anything about the objective world, and science is all about defining the objective world. And he said, no, actually, that's just like Buddhism, especially modern physics, he'd say, and scientists in general, he says, we're limited by our tools of observation, and it basically comes down to our human consciousness. We can use things like microscopes and telescopes, but they're all extensions for our own consciousness, and science tries not to go beyond or recognizes that we can't really go beyond our consciousness or our mind's version of describing things. So I was surprised that he said that. Yes?
A couple of things. The realm of mathematics is, I think, somewhat pertinent here. When Michael was talking about the projection, you know, there's the input coming in and then there's the projection going out. In the realm of mathematics, there's no two out there, or six. I mean, you don't walk through the forest and find a six.
Go on, Sesame Street.
That itself is a human concept.
Well, it helps us define.
Yeah.
And it, there's a kind of beauty in that simple truth that I think we can all agree that there are one, two, three, so many people in this room, 12 maybe. But I found, you know, that this came to mind because I think that's why mathematics has this beautiful purity. Because if you get a collection of mathematicians together, I guess at some point they'll disagree.
Yeah.
But there's some beautiful symmetry in math. There's no discussion of, well, this is black. Well, it's actually got a shade of blue in it. And what is white? I mean, we really do have problems there. You know, when we get into last Sunday program, the speaker was discussing art. And it didn't take long for the discussion to become broader. What is art? Do dogs experience it? Remember? Do animals, do elephants?
Mm.
But with mathematics, there's that precision. The other question I have is, where is it, where does Dogen, does he discuss this, the three states, waking, dream, and deep sleep?
I don't recall any place where he specifically gets into those. I mean, he does have a fascicle called A Dream Within a Dream, where he's kind of like talking about dreaming and like this is a dream too. It's kind of another mind only.
But where is the mind then in deep sleep?
We don't know, right? Our conscious mind doesn't know. Maybe that's like a samadhi where there's no objects. Dreaming is a good example. Also, even in the old Indian tradition, it's the classic demonstration for mind only is a dream, because in a dream you see a three-dimensional world of objects and sounds and colors and so on. And it seems completely real. It seems like an external world. You can be terrified by a wild animal in a dream. You really think it's outside of you, but upon waking, you know that your mind has projected that. It's complete imagination projection. And so they said that shows that the mind can create a very convincing external world. So just like in dream, this tradition would say, in waking life, it's not so different. The mind's also projecting this sense of externality and separateness that doesn't really exist. It's an illusion, like a dream. So, also, you could, when we get into these things like mind only, it's good to remember the point. It's not so much just a, like an interesting philosophy or way of looking at things. It's like medicine for suffering beings. And also, it's not all of Buddhism doesn't agree with this either. This is one school, one tradition called Cittamatra or Yogacara. And other traditions would debate that and say, something's off there. But within that tradition, if we look at that, and Dogen does seem to sometimes come from that tradition. He even has a fascicle called The Three Worlds Are Mind Only. Sangha Yui Shin. But whether or not it's true or not, maybe the main question is does it relieve suffering? Is it suffering is based on the sense of separation and objects and things and people being separate from us, and therefore if there's the slightest separation, there will inevitably be suffering. There's no way out of that. So Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, tries to go to the root of this. It says, let's look at this sense of separation. So mind only is one way to do that. It's just saying that what appears to be out there, let's really closely examine in our own experience how that is so, and is it really out there? And, you know, if we don't use mind only, then the usual other fallback position is the middle way teachings of emptiness. Like, it's not so much about mind only is more about non-duality, about things aren't out there apart from mind, whereas Madhyamaka, middle way, is more about things are empty. We're not so much saying that they're separate from us, we're saying that they don't exist in and of themselves. And that is the same, it's just, you know, very similar medicine. But without deeply realizing either non-duality or non-inherent existence of things, they're going to bother us. Things are going to be a problem. There's no way around it. Sometimes we'll have a good day and they won't be such a problem, but we're just waiting for things to turn and be a problem again. But if we could really see, and this is no small matter to see, to realize this, right? But if we could, you can imagine that even the most horrific things, hundreds, thousands, myriads of objects, horrific objects coming at us, could be not a problem. Just like in a lucid dream, if we were to wake up in a lucid dream and see that those giant fangs of the tiger coming closer to our face, we could be like, this is actually not what I think it is. This is a mental projection. And just as in this world, we might be slightly different in the waking world. But in the big scheme, and from the perspective of the Dharmakaya, maybe not so different. This whole thing, us sitting here in this sesshin, and what we're doing with our lives and all of this is like way beyond what we think it is, according to these teachings, right? So now, to go on, an ancient Buddha said, the mountains, rivers, and great earth are born at the same moment with each person. So there we have it. All Buddhas of the three worlds are practicing together with each person. And by the way, literally it's the three times. It's the same character. We say 10 directions three times. Maybe not that important, but all Buddhas of the three times are practicing together with each person. Just all Buddhas, basically. But here we go. Mountains, rivers, and the great earth are born at the same moment with each person. You know, outside of the mind-only view, isn't that just nonsense? But from the mind-only perspective, isn't that the case? The mountains, rivers, and earth that we experience moment to moment are born at the same time as each of us. In other words, we each have our own mountains, rivers, and earth according to our own perception. And of course, we share a lot. So we can say, like, we can all agree this is a piece of paper. And that's part of the problem we have in really opening to mind only. Is, look, we all see the same one. So that proves it's not just our mind, but a Sangha, in a very detailed way, tries to explain this by saying that it's because we have this shared karmic tendencies from ancient eons of time as sentient beings. We have very, very similar ways of projecting a world. So we can all project a piece of paper pretty similarly. But other species, like a dog, would come in here and, you know, wouldn't actually see it as a piece of paper. They might see something here, but it's not a piece of paper. It's not Dogen to a dog, right? It's food or something.
It could be a jeweled palace.
A jeweled palace. A
necklace. Of,
yeah. Yeah. So that's the classic Yogacara, mind-only metaphor for, you know, all beings see water differently. And therefore, there's no true objective water out there. It's only an appearance of all these different types of beings. So fish see water completely different than humans. Therefore, we can't really say that there's a real water. I think the kind of egocentric or human-centric view would be like saying, the water that we see is the real water, mm-hmm. and fish are diluted.
However, it's their medium, so it's pretty arrogant of us.
Yeah. They're, in a way, you could say they're more intimate with water than we are. But really, we could say we're all equally intimate with it, but in completely different ways. We relate to it differently. And some people would say, well, there really is an objective water, it's just that we all see it differently. That's a kind of watered down version of mind only, and much more palatable. I think that doesn't shock the marrow of our bones so much to say, well, there really isn't water, but we just can't, none of us will really ever know what that water is because we only know it as a human or as a fish or through our own perceptual apparatus. But I think it's shocking. I find it to really like disturbing to my sense of reality to open to the possibility that there may not be an actual objective water out there at all, apart from just all these projections. Like a hologram, right? It's like being literally projected from projectors from all different sides, right? And it looks like a 3D image. And you could see it from different angles, and it still looks 3D, but you can put your hand right through it. It's like merely a projection. Solidity, that's not like a hologram. Well, what is this sense of solidity? Is six senses, right? It's a contact on nerve endings. Physically start looking at what is defining our sense of solidity. It's a nerve ending on the skin, but that's all. There's a committee in there that's saying like, tell Kokyo this is solid matter because his knuckles are starting to hurt. But that committee is just like, you know, programmed to tell me certain things.
Yes. So, I was just trying to think of where this discussion leads to, and I suppose I'm just reminded of like the title of Suzuki Roshi's book, Not Always So. And also the thing that Ajahn Chah says a lot is it just says not so sure, and just pretty much it's sort of like
that's pretty good.
Yeah,
it leads to not so sure, not always so. Like it starts to pull away the rug of our grip on the world being like just like this, like we know what this world is. Starts to be like, this is, I don't know if it's quite like this either, but like, now I'm not so sure, at least that it was the way I thought it was. And our habits are so strong, so we can hear this kind of thing, and sometimes we might even get that like shiver in our bones, like, wait a second, don't talk about this anymore, it's disturbing my view of reality. And then, and because it's very comfortable to live in the world that we've become accustomed to, then it's easy to just forget about this after sashim, and just, okay, let's take care of this world.
Reconstruct the world.
Reconstruct it.
Walk out the door and reconstruct
Yeah. And it's comfortable, but the problem is that it's actually not that comfortable.
But it's familiar.
It's familiar. Yeah, isn't that like, people will do some very self-destructive things in the name of familiarity. Yeah. Well, at least I like know that it's me, and like, and it hurts, and the pain reminds me that at least I exist, and that's comforting. Because not existing, like the way we think we do, is very disconcerting to ourselves. So in a way, we could say it's like an ego trip, but we could say also that the mind only thing is almost like a reverse ego trip. It pulls the rug out on the ego.
Yeah.
In the end, it even though in a way the ego is kind of constructing it, and these are a bunch of like concepts and words, and the human mind constructed this tradition called mind only, but it's kind of a self-destructive construction. I think all the emptiness teachings are like that. They're constructions, but if you take them to the bottom, to the end of where they lead, which takes some work to take them there, it takes some like trust and kind of suspension of our usual sense of things, that then they start to undermine our whole sense of self and who we think we are. And this is kind of disturbing to the self or the ego self, but ultimately totally liberating. So like in the end, well, we don't really know who we are, nothing is always so. And then
Jnaya Avarana.
Jnaya Avarana,
the obstruction of the knowable.
Yeah, that's the last obstruction that's removed for the Dharmakaya to be completely revealed, is Jnaya Avarana, meaning like the last traces of dualistic knowing be one way to talk about it.
Or not holding the fixed views like the metasutra.
Yeah. Uh huh.
Yeah.
Well, we have strong fixed views, and we have coarse views, and then we have very, very subtle views like that. This book stand is not my mind. It's a very, very subtle view. We don't even think of it as a view, right? It's just like, well, that's just the way it is. But the proposal is that's like a mentally constructed view and it's an illusory view that this is not my mind, according to this. Very strange.
Liberating in the sense of where you can see these mind-only teachings, you know, actually work. In the not always so, these wonderful Zen sayings where they just encapsulate really this whole thing. From the sense of suffering when we or I get so locked into something that it becomes really upsetting for me in whatever aspect it is. And maybe sometimes there's a pause and it's like, maybe not always so. And, you know, some of the suffering, or maybe all of the suffering, will just evaporate at that point, just in that application of this mind-only teaching. And so that's the way, I saw it also through studying mind-only teachings. It was really more of a reverse ego thing, you know, so...
And also, it has the potential to remove, to end all suffering. I mean, that's where it's the proposal is. It goes all the way there, but also all along the way, just the little things, just not always so. Just loosening our grip on how we think things are relieves us a little bit, and just in zazen, we can totally experience that holding a certain view. And even like around basic things like this body and so on, and just, well, maybe this is actually, even this physical pain is not exactly what I think it is. I can see how I'm kind of creating, or the mind is creating this, and it just loosens it up. Maybe it doesn't completely eliminate suffering, but everything becomes, there's more space.
We can almost instantaneously create this whole story that doesn't even exist.
And we do.
We do.
Every moment.
Just catching.
Catching ourselves.
Catching that, driving down the road, and you don't appreciate the way somebody else is driving, and immediately just constructed this whole story about who that person is driving this car.
Yeah. And again, then we have...
I know that guy.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
I mean, well, he really is a jerk.
And that's the reason he drives like that.
And that's kind of like one story, and then we have the subtle story that's a person, and that's a car, that car and person are outside this mind.
Right.
And so it goes, you know.
Yeah, just on kind of a coarse level, you know, and because where you can see it actually much more obviously, much more prevalently on a coarser level. And then, like you say, when you drop it down in more subtle understandings.
Yeah.
And
so don't try to control them, as this just great Zen instruction could be done in all kinds of ways in sitting zazen, trying to control our thoughts, for example, trying to control our body, our experience, manage what's going on here, and as a practice of surrendering that control of the self coming forward and trying to manipulate our experience, then we start to open to this more transparent take on things. Things start to loosen up, open up, and into these possibilities of mind only and so on, and also in reverse. So just as a basic instruction, you can just intentionally let go of control, and then the reverse would be like through realizing more and more deeply that things aren't out there the way they appear, then our urge to control becomes less and less.
We learn to suck it up.
What's that?
We learn to just... we don't really end suffering. We just learn how to...
I wouldn't say really suck it up, though, because suck it up's kind of like, I can bear it, you know? This is more like... it's more like it's still going on, but it's like my whole relationship to it's different. Like, it's now it's like, oh, how interesting. Oh, my knee really hurts. Like, what is that? It's a miracle. Like, I don't even know what that is anymore. And so letting it all be as it is without resistance, you know, sucking it up sounds a little more like
giving up.
Or like, I can take it, you know, being strong or something. This is more like not even trying to be strong, giving up trying to be strong. Just like, I totally surrender. Just like, Dharmakaya, take me wherever you will.
In Zazen, sometimes we create an agenda, you know, a little project.
Yeah. Or a big one.
Or a big one, yeah. Yeah, but I think it's clear that when we relax that tendency,
yeah,
then we still acknowledge that there's an agenda producing machine in us, you know.
Yeah.
And we sort of confess that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that acknowledgement kind of gives it space. It doesn't really disappear. Mm. We know we have a tendency to
an agenda creating machine.
Yeah.
Agenda creating committee.
Yeah. Yeah, we can maybe like that committee is still having their like deliberations and their business meeting up here. And it's kind of like, okay, you guys just go ahead and meet. I'm going to take a rest now myself. Enjoy your meeting. I'm just going to sit Zazen over here. And then they'd be like, then they all look at you and be like, what do you mean? I thought you were the chairman of this meeting. No, no, I'm just taking a rest. Well, then maybe we should too. Hey guys, what do you say? Let's all go out for tea.
Ice cream.
Yeah, we'll meet later. Postpone this meeting.
We'll be back. Yeah.
To when that guy will join us again. To when the chairman is back at this at the head seat.
So the interesting thing I find about it is that, like people, you know, more accomplished Zen masters and that seem quite confident with the world, but normally associate confidence with knowing how things are, but they're confident with not knowing how things are.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, being okay in this world and with how things go, and still getting caught by the world. I mean, it's a pretty believable dream. So there's that, you know, I think of that one story, like there was some great master who wasn't caught by anything, and the monks were like, we can't like find this guy anywhere. He's just like not disturbed by anything. We can't find his mind. And so they're like, in a Zen temple, right? So then at night they go out and they're like, scatter food like all over the courtyard and make a big mess. And then in the morning the master comes and they find his mind. He has a little moment of like, who made this mess? And like, this isn't right. So like the world kind of like impinged on his, he believed that it was not his mind. Yeah.
This is sort of a self, a humility, ability to laugh at yourself because you know that you'll be tricked by the world.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, maybe almost even appreciating being tricked by the world in a certain way. Like, wow, yep, this mind that really...
turned me around.
Yeah. Hmm? Did it turn me around?
Yeah, I thought it was one way and... Wow.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Because again, the Dharmakaya is like, you know, the the crimson flowers blooming along the stream, and the, you know, grass in the, under the shady trees. So the mountains, rivers, and great earth are born at the same moment with each person. All Buddhas of the three worlds are practicing together with each person. If we look at the mountains, rivers, and earth, when a person is born, his birth does not seem to be bringing forth additional mountains, rivers, and earth on top of the existing ones. Right, so isn't this the way we think? We're like, that's ridiculous. If the mountains are born the same moment as us, then there's already the real mountains that already exist there, right? And when we're born, we don't seem to make a new layer of mountains on top of those mountains. That would be, you know, that doesn't make sense. But we could say the problem here is that thinking that there's the existing ones that were there before that person was born. That's, we usually think that there were. These mountains were here before we were born. But mind only would say they weren't, right? I mean, maybe your mountains were here. But my mountains weren't here until I was born. So they're not really being added on top of some existing ones, pre-existing ones. There's no mountains apart from mine. Yet the ancient Buddha's word cannot be mistaken. How should we understand this? Even if you do not understand it, you should not ignore it. So be determined to understand it. Since this word is already expounded, you should listen to it. Listen until you understand. So we've been talking about one way of understanding that's kind of the really traditional mind-only version of that there isn't a set of pre-existing mountains, rivers, and earth. Before there were sentient beings, there wasn't a world. As soon as there's sentient beings, then we have sentient beings with a consciousness that can project a world. Then we have a so-called world. But that's a very unusual way of thinking. We think that there was a world before there were sentient beings, a pre-existing one. But then if people kept adding more and more worlds on top of that, we'd have like, it would get too thick. We'd have too many worlds. But if there wasn't one there before, then we can each very neatly project our world, and all our projections are very neatly and inconceivably interpenetrating, overlapping, at least interdependent worlds. Therefore, I can hold this up and like my projected piece of paper and your projected piece of paper are inconceivably interdependent, so we can both agree that's a piece of paper. Just like those hologram cameras are all like shooting onto the same thing. But then Dogen says, this is how to understand. Is there anyone who knows what his birth and its beginning or end is like? No one knows either birth's end or its beginning. Nevertheless, everyone is born. Similarly, no one knows the extremities of the mountains, rivers, and earth, but all see this place and walk here. We could hear that as similar to what we've been talking about, the extremities of our birth and the extremities of the mountains. You know, we don't know really what they are. They're not what we think they are with our limited consciousness. Do not think with regret that the mountains, rivers, and earth are not born with you. Understand that the ancient Buddha teaches that your birth is not separate from the mountains, rivers, and earth. Does that ring true according to like the way we've been kind of exploring mind-only perspective? That the mountains, rivers, and earth are not the slightest bit separate from you, meaning your mind. Again, all Buddhas of the three worlds have already practiced, attained the way, and completed realization. How should we understand that those Buddhas are practicing together with us? So now, same principle we could say here, but now we're talking about only a Buddha and a Buddha again. How is it that all the Buddhas are practicing together with us? How is it that Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived in ancient India long ago, entered Parinirvana, how is it that he is practicing with us right now? Without this understanding of mind only, it might just sound like a weird thing. I mean, we could just take it on faith as a nice idea, but how is it really so? But if we see that Shakyamuni Buddha, any Shakyamuni Buddha that there is our Shakyamuni Buddha. If there's not a Shakyamuni Buddha out there, over there in India, apart from our mind, right? Or if there, again, if we don't want to go quite that far, we could say if there was a Shakyamuni Buddha who lived from 523 BC to 483 BC in Magadha. If there was such a person that lived like that at that time, we have no way of knowing that. And we can read in the sutras like about that Buddha, right? But we're reading about that Buddha. So the only way we know about Shakyamuni Buddha is through our mind, right? And someone in some African rainforest who's never heard about Buddhism or Shakyamuni Buddha, there isn't Shakyamuni Buddha. We could say, well, no, there really was. And then we make an additional one on top of that one. But like, no.
So basically, we could say that the reality only exists for us as far as we can see.
As far as we can see at that time.
So if we're looking at mountains,
mm-hmm.
and we can't see the mountains behind the mountains, and we have no map in our mind, mm-hmm. We haven't visited those mountains before. Mm-hmm. Those mountains don't exist for us.
Well, if we see them.
If we don't see them. And we have no map and no memory.
Yeah.
Those mountains did not exist.
Yeah, I think that's how I understand mind only. And then some people would say, well, what about, I've heard this kind of weird story, that like, what about this like certain mountaintop on the top of some Himalayan mountain where no sentient being has ever seen that mountaintop? And you could say, well, does that mountaintop exist? I would understand it as actually, no, it doesn't exist. But I have heard this one teacher talking about it like, well, if any sentient being has ever experienced it before, then in a way it exists for
it actually exists as a concept.
As a concept.
Right then.
Yeah, as soon as we think of it, right? Yeah. As soon as we talk about that tip of that mountain, there we have it. I think that's the most straightforward way to talk about it, is that. Yeah, and in a way you could say like, like outside the Zendo door there, is there a moss garden? And you could say, yeah, I know it is because I've seen it so many times. But strictly speaking, right, like for us, there's not a moss garden there, right? Until we open the door and see it, and then it's there again. And we say, well, we can do various scientific experiments to prove that it's there when we're not there. Like we could set up a camera, and then we could have the screen in here. But then, if we do that, then it is there for us because we see that image. And in a way,
also memory.
And memory, yeah. So in a way, it's there.
Memory is a camera.
Yeah, our mind is creating an image of it right now, so it does exist as our mind camera. Yeah, memory camera.
Or even if it was described to us by someone else, and we formed a concept.
Yeah. Like a unicorn can exist in our mind because we have an image of it, even though it might not exist in objective reality. But mind only would say that there actually isn't an objective reality that we can know or experience apart from our mind, so that there's not really much difference between a unicorn and a horse. Thinking of a unicorn and thinking of a horse. Except you can say conceptual imagination is a little different. It is different from direct sensory experience. But direct sensory experience is also mind only. That's, it goes that far, Sissy, you know, that the color, with before there's any conceptual overlay, is a mental, is a mind image of color and sound. We can't get at this world. It's almost like you say we can imagine there's like a world behind our projected world. And this is where I'm willing to say, like, maybe so. Maybe so, maybe not. Either way, it seems like by definition, there's no matter how far science gets advanced and so on, we'll never be able to know if there is or not. Because all we ever have is mind. To, you know, we have lots of technical instruments and they can measure lots of things, but it's all of that is mind-created instruments, right? And the instruments just show things to show information to our mind. So we can get more and more accurate pictures of how we project things. But that you know, that true thing as it is, like I think Western tradition says there's like a noumenon, like behind the phenomena, like the true thing in itself, behind our perceptions of it. If that's what we mean by noumenon, we say, well, no, we can't, it's not a matter of ever getting to know that kind of noumenon. We just all we experience is phenomenon. Unless we say that the noumena is the Dharmakaya, which is not an objective world. Dharmakaya is like the pure, non-dual awareness, completely free from all projections. And then we have the Zen people saying that is like that. That pure Dharmakaya, free from all projections, is this like vast mountains, rivers, and earth. So it's bringing it all back home.
What's the line in the Ginchi Koan about even though you sail into the middle of the ocean, you can only see so far, sort of thing, and there's lots of worlds beyond it or something like that?
Square and round.
Yeah, you only see as far as your eye of practice can reach.
Yes.
Although, though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, we see only as far as our eye of practice can reach.
So as well as being round or square, and the ocean will manifest.
The ocean looks circular. Yeah, it does not look any other way, but yeah, it's neither round nor square. Features are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there.
And even in one...
This is so not only all around us, but directly beneath our feet. It's like this.
In one drop of water or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hear that as similar teaching that we're like I sometimes I've been talking about, like, we're in this mind-only bubble. Like, it's this bubble of our, like, you can start to see the world as, like, just a visual world. There's many other senses, but just as an image, our visual world is, like, that's the extent of that's as far as our eye or practice can reach, in a way. We can then look at that distant horizon, and our bubble becomes really big. But actually, you could say, in a way, our bubble doesn't become any bigger. That's just, like, the screen of our mind is just doesn't become bigger and smaller. It's just we're like encapsulated in this, like, my, it's like we're in a movie. We're just in a continuous movie, and we don't know what the world is like outside of our movie. It's just a weird way of thinking, and that sounds really limited. That sounds kind of depressing, like we're stuck in this little, you know, almost two-dimensional movie. It's three-dimensional, but like we're kind of stuck in our own movie. That small sounds screen. So yeah, small screen. It sounds so limited and almost like we're trapped in here. But actually, if we reflect on that, experience, if we start to open to experiencing things like we're trapped in our little movie, the whole thing is very, very open. It's kind of like, because that movie is completely flexible, like, and anything can happen there, because it's a movie. It's the possibilities are endless. Whole worlds are there in our little movie. But if we think it's not just our little movie, we think that the mountains out there are apart from me, then they're gonna cause us trouble. They're gonna impinge on us. There'll be nice mountains on a nice day, and then a big storm will come and we'll suffer. So we have this teaching, like,